Hello and welcome to a special edition of the France 24 debate. It's only the second time that Iran has directly targeted Israel with missiles. The first was back in April after the assassination in Tehran of Ismail Haniyeh. Dozens of rockets fired after what's been a run where Israel has assassinated the leader of Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah. Has also taken out the top command of the militant group and made a push in southern Lebanon, taking out other militant groups. Iran, which has been warning Israel not to retaliate, saying more missiles would be fired. We know they're ballistic missiles because, well, the air raid sirens went off. Iran does not share a border with Israel. And 8 to 12 minutes later, there was the Iron Dome coming in. With us to talk about it is our international affairs editor, Kedavan Gorgestani. Also with us here in the studio, Hamdan Mostafavi, deputy editor-in-chief of French news magazine L'Express. We want to thank Hussein Ibish from joining us from Washington, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute. Your latest piece in The Atlantic is How Hezbollah Got Caught in Its Own Trap. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Francois. Thank you.
From Tel Aviv, he's a former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Itamar Rabinovich, founder and president of the Israel Institute. Thank you for being with us.
Well,
and from Nice, Miriam Benhad, professor of international relations at Schiller University, author in French of The Mechanics of Conflict. We can, begin with the latest, if you're just joining us. Kedavan Gorgestani, we were saying earlier that this is very different from what was witnessed in April.
Absolutely. There's a sense that while there was a warning and that the Americans and the Israelis were prepared for this to happen, it seems that the scale, at least the speed at which these missiles reached Israel is not like what we had last time, where we waited for those drones and those missiles to arrive once we had the sort of announcement that they had been sent from Iran. And you have now the Israeli army that is saying that the attack on Israel is continuing. You have the Iranian Revolutionary Guards who is saying that this is basically a revenge for the killing of major leaders, of including Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah. You also have the Iranian Revolutionary Guard warning Israel that they would respond in an even bigger way if Israel were to retaliate. So we're sort of in a sort of waiting pattern right now because it seems to have come down, but we saw that there were actually two waves of these missiles. At some point, we thought that it had stopped, and then it started again. So we're waiting to see what that information will be coming out of Israel, because they are saying right now, at least the last announcement was about 5 minutes ago, that it was continuing. And according to the wire agencies that are saying overheard on Israeli military radio, the Israeli military is talking about nearly 200 missiles, at least for now.
Let's see if we can go to Tehran and correspondent Saeed Amini. Saeed, are there reactions? Are there further reactions where you are?
There are reactions. I don't think people have actually gotten to their homes. I see them walking in the pedestrian to their homes. I don't have any further information. The street of my place is very quiet. Have this information that the second barrage is over the skies of Tabriz, and it will probably reach Israel in 70 minutes, probably 70 minutes. And this operation is done not just by the IRGC Air Force Division, it's also backed by the Iranian army and the defense ministry. So this means that Iran will not be emptying its stock in entirety. Iran has thought of a plan B, which is the Israeli retaliation.
As you're saying, 7 to 8 minutes for those for that next salvo.
Sorry, 70 to 80.
70 to 80. Okay, so that would infer that we're not talking about ballistic missiles this time.
Yes, sir.
Hamdan Mostafavi.
Yes.
This is unprecedented.
This is a very large scale operation, as we can see. It is a... We are all very emotional, of course, with what's going on. Maybe we can just put a bit of context to explain what's going on now. Israel has been targeting, we know, Hamas and then Hezbollah and many important leaders of the IRGC, the Pasdaran, the Islamic army, let's say, of Iran. So now Iran...
You were expecting at some point.
Iran has what we all have in mind. So what's next? Who was going to Israel target next? Iranian leaders feel that they need to send a strong message that Israel should stop and not go after their own leader. They've killed Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. That shows that no one in Iran is safe. No leader is safe in Iran. So I think that retaliation from Iran is a way to say to Israel, we will attack, don't go further, because we will escalate if you target us.
Itamar Rabinovich joins us now by telephone from Tel Aviv. Itamar, thank you for being with us here on
sure.
France 24. I suspect you're in a safe place.
I am in a shelter right now, yes.
Is it quiet where you are?
No, actually, we had alarms. We had some falls not too far from where we are. We don't know whether this was a missile or whether this were part of the anti-missile.
And no.
But there were falls very close to where we are, yes.
You heard Hamdan Mostafavi who basically saying that after... those strings of setbacks for Iran's proxies. Everybody was waiting for the other shoe to drop. Were you expecting this?
Yes, I was expecting this because for a very long time, the Iranians have been hiding behind and using proxies. Lebanese, Palestinians, Yemenites, Iraqis, Syrians, and as people in here in this part of the world used to say that the Iranians would fight to the last Arab, to the last Palestinian, and so forth and so forth. Now, they've both been embarrassed after the killing of Nasrallah in Lebanon, and they think that the proxies and our public opinion, and maybe their own public opinion, are expecting them to finally do something themselves directly. Of course, by doing this, they are exposing themselves to retaliation, and the prospect or the fear of a regional war is now quite realistic.
You're expecting a retaliation.
I'm expecting a retaliation. When we were first attacked by Iran on 1814. Israel retaliated with a thin prick, just indicating that it had the ability to retaliate and did not want to escalate. This time it's a much more massive attack, much more massive, directed this time at civilian areas, not at a military base. And there will be a retaliation, I have no doubt about that.
Hussein Ibish, are we still within... I don't know how to say this. Maybe under using the old Cold War parlance of a calibration, where each side knows what the other one is doing, or is it spinning out of control?
Yeah, it's spinning out of control. Without a doubt, it's spinning out of control. I mean, the scale and intensity of this attack appears to be One that, as Dr. Rabinowitz was saying, will definitely call for a retaliation in Israel. And this itself is undoubtedly motivated mainly by Iranian domestic public opinion. I don't think Iran would do this, to mollify Arab views. I think it would, and I don't see how this really is terribly in Iran's strategic interest. It's got to be a response intended to reassure the public at home that this regime is capable of defending the national interests robustly. And when a strategy like Iran's forward defense by using Arab proxies, Arabs that they've conned into fighting for them, and as Mr. Rabinowitz was saying, fighting to the last Palestinian, the last Lebanese, that's absolutely right. But when that policy fails and collapses, then I think there is a real danger in Iran of the public, not the general public, but element, powerful people, elite groups saying to themselves, maybe this leadership is not capable of defending Iranian national interests. Maybe we need some adjustment. Maybe we need a different set of leaders. Maybe we really need some change. And of course, the aging supreme leader sets up a situation where that could be instantiated. And you'd have to be very concerned about your domestic credibility in Tehran if your whole national security policy just crumbles around you and you don't say anything, you don't do anything. You look very weak and very feckless.
Yeah, I want to get Hamdan Mostafavi's reaction in a second. But first, Kedavan Gorgestani, these live images, we're seeing the Iron Dome in force at this moment. These are live pictures from Tel Aviv.
Yes, and again, we're seeing, which is now the third barrage of missiles that we've seen.
Oh, sorry, I'm sorry, my bad. These are not live images.
Okay,
these are from a few minutes ago. So
this was the second barrage of missiles that were being intercepted. And for the people who don't know, the sort of explosions, the balls of fire that you see in the sky, that's when the missiles are being intercepted. And we know, according to the Israeli army, that there have been almost 200 of these missiles sent. The timing between the announcement that they were being sent from Iran to when they reached Israel seemed to indicate that these could be ballistic missiles, because it was about a dozen minutes between the announcement and when we saw them flying over the sky in Israel. And to double down on what you were saying about the position of the Iranian regime, as in, you are attacking us. There was that speech by Benjamin Netanyahu speaking to the Iranian people where he said, we will go after any person anywhere that is a threat to us. And he also hinted at the possibility of a regime change. So this also could feed into the need for the Iranian regime to sort of show this display of force and show that they will respond and they will not let Israel just continue attacking.
Hamdan Mostafavi, over the last 11 and a half months in this studio, we've talked a lot about the two tracks for Israel. That is, the war in Gaza coupled with the intricacies of domestic policy.
Of course.
You just heard Hussein Ibish saying that in Iran, same thing. You have what's happening with Israel, and you have a domestic calculus in what the regime is thinking and strategizing right now.
It can be part of the reflection, of course, because they've appeared very weakened, especially with attacks directly in Iran. And of course, Nasrallah is a huge symbol in Iran. You have pictures of Hassan Nasrallah in the streets of Iran, as you have the pictures of Khamenei and Khomeini. So he was also a picture of the regime. So they have
The Iranian regime.
Yeah, of course, he was considered like a part of. He spoke Persian. He was like a brother to these people. So even in Iran, his image is very important. So, I mean, as for the regime, for the people, there's been, 2 years ago, massive demonstrations in Iran. There has been some discontent about how expensive life is, about civil rights, about women's rights. So you can think maybe it can come into calculation, but I think it's mostly a show of force towards Israelis and maybe Americans, even if it's a bit of a trap for the Iranians, because either they retaliate like they did to show off. Because one of the main questions after the attack in April was, do they have much more power? Is it all that they can show, or can they show more? And I think they're trying to show they have more.
Miriam Ben-Rad, are we at the cusp of more escalation, more radicalization? Or is this the point where people step back from the brink?
I think you've tackled a lot of very important points, and I would like to go out to the title of this show tonight, All That War? Question mark. You also asked whether this escalation is limited, has no limits. I think that what we're seeing is the continuation of this long cycle of revenge that started on the 7th of October, that was followed by the war in Gaza, and that has seen since an extension of the realm of war. So we've seen, of course, the proxies, what are called the proxies of Iran act against Israel, although all of this is a very complex landscape of actors, sometimes acting on their own because of their own resentment and hate of Israel. We've seen Israel retaliate through more and more spectacular operations, which also explains why Iran feels righteous to retaliate through the second spectacular attack. Indeed, it's the second spectacular attack since April. At the same time, the real question is, I think, how far are the different players ready to go? Because you mentioned regime change, and regime change would imply a much more serious implication of the U.S. To back Israeli operations. That would indeed mean an all-out war on the ground, which I don't think any American administration is ready for at the moment. But this is something that comes back very often in the discourse of Netanyahu, and it's the obsession of the Iranians.
Miriam, can the United States, which is sort of in this limbo period ahead of its elections on November 5th, does it have the nous to prevent that all-out war?
That's the whole problem. I think that a lot of American officials I talked to feel that the U.S. is being drawn back into the Middle East deadlock through this escalation. I don't think this is an all-out war at the moment. I think we're not entirely on the brink, but there is clearly an aggravation of violence, an extension, as I said, of the realm of war through these constant attacks and reprisals on each camp. What I think is the main tragedy is the failure, even I would say the death of diplomacy, because we've seen the U.S. and many other European nations, the whole international community try to step into this crisis and generate this de-escalation process with no success. So indeed, this has also, this is what I tried to explain in a recent interview, I think this has created a sense of impunity on all parts, that they can go even farther with unintended consequences. That's the main question today. How far will they go? And will we witness unintended consequences? I will end with one point, among which the U.S. being again drawn back against its will into this Middle Eastern mess, which I don't think, again, any American administration wants, but that's the slow process, the very dangerous dynamic that we see today.
All right, Miriam, they're deploring the absence or the ineffectiveness of diplomacy. And before we get the diplomat on our panel to react, let's go to France 24's Claire Pacalin, who's in East Jerusalem. What's the latest where you are?
Well, as you can see behind me, the streets are very quiet. Not many people are venturing out. Everyone is making sure that they are near an air raid shelter if they need to get to one. We are staying at a hotel which has a basement and very thick old walls, so we will be safe. And if we need to stop this live so that I can get to an air raid shelter, I will do so. We have seen now three different sets, sort of barrages of missiles coming through the skies in the last hour. I haven't seen any since I last spoke to you, François, but we have since heard from Iran's Revolutionary Guard, who said that if Israel were to respond, well, then Iran's response would be more crushing and devastating than before.
And Saeed Amini is our correspondent in Tehran. Saeed, you were reporting that another salvo was on its way.
Yes, there will be a third wave, as Claire mentioned. There will be a third wave, as I got off with my sources. And the interesting point is that neighbors in my neighborhood are chanting Allahu Akbar, which is the Arabic for God is great. This is a chant that is being said if they want to praise an action done by the Islamic Republic. So apparently there are different reactions to this. Some were running scared to their houses. Some cars I saw, they were passing really fast. As typical with the Iranians, they're probably getting their gas fields filled so that they would leave Tehran and its outskirts and would head towards the north of the country in case of an Israeli retaliation. But I'm seeing very different reactions, very diverse reactions. And there is a third wave coming, apparently.
A third wave coming, apparently. There have also been in the southern suburbs of Beirut, which are strongholds of Hezbollah, people firing shots in the air in celebration. The French news agency AFP, quoting emergency services, is saying there have been two light injuries so far in that Iran missile attack. Itamar Rabinovich, when you're a diplomat hunkering down because of an air raid, do you still believe in diplomacy?
Even more so. You don't have to quote Clausewitz to know that you cannot separate war from diplomacy. Once serves the other, one feeds the other, and maybe diplomacy could not prevent this escalation, but diplomacy should come in, take advantage of the fact that everybody realizes that the damage is manifold, and try to broker a deal out of this. I know that there are moderate voices in Tehran, even inside the regime, that think that the radicals and the revolutionary guard have been pushing Iran in the wrong direction. I think many Iranians ask themselves what kind of an investment was made in all of this. How much was invested in building Hezbollah to the extent that it is and equipping it to that extent? It cost billions and billions of dollars in a country that suffers from sanctions and economic difficulties. And I'm not sure that there will be reckoning, but there will be questions. Now, as I've been said correctly, this is not a great time for diplomacy for the United States on the eve of an election. But we can put it this way. After November 5, an election will be decided. President Biden remains president until January 20th, and he's a free agent. So there are prospects for diplomacy. And let me also mention the other Gulf states, the Emiratis, the Saudis, the others, who are looking at all of this and are asking themselves, they have been afraid of Iran. They've been expecting American support and as the patron superpower. And they're asking themselves, how reliable is the United States? That is another question that needs to be asked and is being asked in Washington.
And if I may, for there to be diplomacy, there also has to be Israel that wants to negotiate. Israel, which has the most right-wing government in its history currently. Now, Benjamin Netanyahu's had a pretty good 2 weeks with lots of military successes. Does he barter those into some kind of de-escalation, or does he double down?
Well, I think he and most Israelis would like to see a negotiated settlement, both in Gaza, to end the war in Gaza and bring the hostages home, and in Lebanon to enable the 70,000 Israelis who had to leave their homes near the Lebanese border to go back and to live there safely. So they used to be at the end of the second Lebanon war in 2006, we had Security Council Resolution 1701, which should have established a security regime in the region. It was not really maintained. This would be an opportunity to create 1702, let's call it, with massive international support that could bring an end to that. And let me put it even in stronger terms. It's time to restore the Lebanese state. Unfortunately, the Lebanese state became an empty shell with Hezbollah really running the country to a bad end. And there are still many, many Lebanese who would like to see what used to be a flourishing, attractive country in the Middle East go back to a model of what used to be a coexistence among numerous religious and ethnic communities. So it's not just Israel and the Arabs, or Israel and Lebanon. It's about restoring the Lebanese state to being the real state.
And if you're joining us on France 24, these are not live images. They're from earlier. Israel's military, which has said that, quote, for now, there is no more a threat from the skies. Hussein Ibish, your reaction to what you just heard there from Itamar Rabinovich over the possibility of diplomacy?
I mean, a very, very interesting comment. So, first of all, the nostalgia that came pouring out of me when he described the Lebanon I grew up in was pretty profound. And I do agree with him that the biggest obstacle to the resurrection of that Lebanon and the resurrection of the Lebanese state as a truly functioning national centralized project is the disarmament of Hezbollah and turning it into a functional political party if it can survive as simply a party. But there's no real path to do that. I mean, the international community could start to create a path that goes gently in that direction, but you have to be very careful now. The Shiite community in Lebanon is pretty traumatized at the moment, and you have to tread a little bit softly, given the power balances there. Now, as for broader diplomacy, I think that maybe in a funny way, the most interesting opening at the moment is one potentially between the United States and Iran on the nuclear question. The Iranians are putting out a lot of feelers at UNGA and elsewhere, being very clear. At least the president has been doing it, and apparently with the backing of the supreme leader. I mean, that seems clear that he wants to resume negotiations. They need sanctions. They really kind of miss the JCPOA, and they've made a lot of progress towards nuclear weapons status, but they haven't crossed the threshold. So it is conceivable that you could see a JCPOA 2.0 that is, not to, like the old JCPOA, not to everybody's liking, but that does forestall a nuclear Iran and yet provides it with sanctions relief. And, with the kind of a collapse of Iran's forward defense policy based on these militias, maybe that could be somehow part of the negotiation, which was sorely lacking last time. As for the second most likely one, might even be something in Lebanon. I think you could see, as Dr. Rabinovich was saying, a 1702 or 1701.
Just to remind our viewers, Resolution 1701 from 2006, which called for a demilitarized buffer zone patrolled by the UN.
It called for belligerent forces to pull back to approximately to the Litani River, and for the LAF the Lebanese Armed Force and UNIFIL, the UN force, both of them to be in the border area. And it basically was a coded way of saying Hezbollah should not bring large numbers of personnel and heavy equipment into the south of Lebanon, which is basically what Israel has been demanding in the past year. There is the potential for Iran, and therefore Hezbollah, to conclude that right now discretion is the better part of valor. It would be wiser for them to preserve what is left of Hezbollah's missile arsenal and manpower, go to ground, rebuild, try to restructure command and control, and sue for peace, essentially. And they could try to do a deal pretending that it's a deal of the Lebanese government, because it's all people always deal with the Lebanese government, and Hezbollah signs off on it. This is how the maritime border agreement was done, and you could see something like that. It is not at all beyond imagining that Iran could conclude that this is the best solution in Lebanon right now. It's just somehow to decouple Lebanon and Gaza and go for an agreement.
Even despite what we've been witnessing the last hour?
Yes, because I would say that what we're witnessing in the past hour, to me, looks very much like something for Iranian domestic public opinion. I'm not downplaying how dangerous this is. I agree that a Israeli response will undoubtedly be called for. I think we have to see in the end how much damage is done, what was targeted, and how. So Israel will calibrate how much it wants to escalate or what it thinks is necessary to restore deterrence. But at the same time, the basic calculation of Iran, and I believe also most leaders in Israel, not all, but most, is that they do not want a war right now with each other or a major war between Hezbollah and Israel, for that matter. And so, yes, I think they might sign off on that, and I think they might look for an off-ramp because it's gone really badly for them. And they never stood anything to gain from joining a battle that began over Hamas and Gaza. They don't care about Hamas. They consider it unreliable. And Gaza means nothing to them. So this, they're being essentially dragged into this because they were benefiting gratis from a war that was being paid for in Palestinian and Israeli blood. And it made no sense. So Israel called the bluff, and here we are. The most difficult negotiation I to imagine succeeding is the Gaza ceasefire, unfortunately, which is the key to all the others. And so it's really unfortunate that I don't see either Yahya Sinwar or Benjamin Netanyahu as believing it's in their personal political interests to negotiate a ceasefire. Both of them might go for a kind of pause, you know, if they could get prisoners and if it's on their own terms. But I think both of them are happy to see the insurgency versus counterinsurgency in Gaza that's developed after the Rafah campaign concluded. That serves both of their interests really nicely. And I expect it to continue, unfortunately, because they're two very cynical leaders at play here, in my view.
All right. We have good news. Well, you've probably gotten it before, Itamar Rabinovich. The Israeli army saying that citizens can now leave their shelters.
Excellent.
Go ahead. You've left already.
No, I was saying maybe he left. Yeah.
Let me cross to Miriam Ben-Had on all this, because we saw, like, last week when Hassan Nasrallah was assassinated, there were far right coalition partners of Benjamin Netanyahu who worried that this wasn't a good idea because perhaps it would force Israel to quickly wind up its operations in Gaza. Do you agree with Hussein Ibish that Gaza is the hardest piece of this puzzle?
I think every piece of this puzzle is very tough if we're realistic. And there's a lot of ideology currently in the different discourses of the Israeli government. I mean, if you listen to Netanyahu, on my side, I have the feeling sometimes that I'm hearing a sort of bis repetita of what I heard right after September 11, during the preparation of the Iraq war. We have references to the axis of evil. Netanyahu said that he wants to shape a new order. I will be very frank with you. I've been working on this region for a long time. I don't believe in this political engineering. I don't believe in magic. I don't believe that military force will bring democracy or create out of the blue a new order in Lebanon, because the killing of Nasrallah is one thing. The fragilization of Lebanon, post-Civil War Lebanon, the extremely weak sectarian balances, equilibriums that exist in Lebanon. Lebanon is a failed state, not to even mention the economic crisis that has brought the country to its knees. All of this creates a very complex landscape, which, by the way, the Israelis know, and they know very well that they are not going to create this new deal just by, the disproportionate use of force. So if you ask me, again, I think there's a lot of ideology. I don't think it's going to lead us very far. Maybe the buffer on the buffer zone question, it's very interesting because it may be the end result of all of this, a sort of return to the previous status quo that would be even more fragile with buffer zones, with a complete unknown equation in Gaza. That's also a problem. We have seen the attention shifting to Lebanon and Iran, but what about Gaza? What's going to come next? I have seen no real plan on the Israeli part. Again, I will finish on this word. I don't believe in magic, so let's see what they propose politically, because that's also the problem. Politics are absent.
What is certain is that with or without diplomacy, there may be things shifting as a result of what we've seen over the last 2 weeks and what we've seen in the last hours. In his speech last week, last Thursday, before the United Nations, Benjamin Netanyahu, we saw him openly court Saudi Arabia and countries keen on containing Iran's influence over the region. Let's take a listen.
On the one hand, a bright blessing, a future of hope. On the other hand, a dark future of despair. And if you think this dark map is only a curse for Israel, if you think that, then you should think again.
What did you think of his show and tell session, Hamdan Mostafavi?
Well, I think Miriam kind of pointed out it out. It's interesting to see, I think, the relationship between the U.S. and between what Benjamin Netanyahu wants. I think the main issue is that they don't really want the same thing. Netanyahu really clearly states it. He wants regime change in Iran. He wants to drag the U.S. into that war.
But he also wants normalization with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, of course, but that's two different goals that are totally possible together, because you can be friends with Saudi Arabia. That would change the whole Middle East. Of course, let's go back to before the 7th of October. That used to be something that people were starting to imagine. A year ago, I remember waiting for the announcement at any time, an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Israel that would have changed the Middle East. It was not that easy, of course. Let's not try to make it look very easy. It was, of course, very complicated. But I think today Netanyahu really states that, I don't know if is it for political reasons, is it for... I don't really see the long-term strategic vision of it. And that's what everybody has been wondering. Where does Israel want to go with that? Is it just short-term view and trying, to preserve the power? Is it just revenge? Or is there a plan for Gaza, for Iran? I think the plan that Netanyahu has is not the same that the U.S., and this is going to be a problem, whoever is the president.
Whoever is the president, Ketevan Gorgestani.
Well, we were talking about how there was a domestic element to what was going on both in Iran and in Israel. There's also a domestic element in the United States to the reaction, because we're about a month away now from the November 5th election. And of course, Donald Trump was very quick to put out a statement about what was happening. And clearly, this is going to play into the campaign, which is that he has been saying all along that with him, there would have been no war. This escalation would not have happened. He says that war is now, and the threat of war is raging everywhere, and the two incompetents running this country are leading us to the brink of World War III. He says that it's no surprise that Iran desperately wants Kamala Harris to be president, because they know as long as she's in power, they can take advantage of America. And he concludes a very long statement by saying, if Kamala gets four more years, the world goes up in smoke. So this is feeding into the rhetoric and obviously feeding into the Republican campaign. But it also is, in a way, playing into the Democratic campaign, because Joe Biden is still the president, but he also has a vice president who's running. And this is all a calculation. Obviously, the Americans don't want an escalation right now, don't want a full-out war, but they definitely don't want it to happen before the November 5th election, because the last thing they need right now is yet another war, full-out war happening in the world under their watch.
So, Itamar Rabinovich, the window for de-escalation is a narrow one. Particularly, again, we're waiting on what the result is of the U.S. elections. You heard Hamdan questioning whether Benjamin Netanyahu is capable of doing deals with his rivals. And so where does that leave what Hussein was talking about earlier, the possibility that, you know, that there are these hints coming from Iran that they are willing to revisit the nuclear deal?
This would be very good news, but let me bring another element to the picture. Of course, Israeli-Saudi normalization and the two countries being in the cornerstone of a, say, moderate Middle Eastern coalition connected to Washington, hostile to Iran, would be a great achievement for Israeli and American diplomacy. But there's always the Palestinian element. The Saudis will not do it without at least a serious prospect of negotiating not just a solution to Gaza, but also to the larger Palestinian issue. The Netanyahu government, in its present composition, is incapable of doing that. And Netanyahu will have to make a very bold decision about his legacy. He said, of course, his public standing in Israel has been shaken by the failure on October 7th. He needs to redeem himself. That kind of a deal could be a redeemer. And he's promised sort of a security safety net by the opposition if he wants to make the deal, and then he can go to elections as the man who brought peace with Saudi Arabia. That is a gamble he'll have to take if he wants to go down in history as the prime minister with a legacy.
And right now, in the coming hours and days, is it it's a rally round the flag moment, or will there be Israelis calling for de-escalation?
No, I think rallying around the flag. Remember, there's still a limited military operation in South Lebanon, trying to prepare the ground for the return of the 70,000 Israelis who have fled or left the border area. Gaza has become less of an issue right now. It's on the back burner, if I may say that. And Lebanon is the focus of attention now, of course, Iran is as well. But you'll find the country in a bellicose mood right now. There'll have to be a period of de-escalation before we can shift from the current mode to a peace and deal-making mode.
Hamdan Mostafavi?
Yeah, I think that if you want peace, I mean, if you want peace to be there, somebody needs to want the peace to be done. So there is not currently, I don't see really actors going towards that peace. Netanyahu has to make some changes and go beyond the political moment and try to find some way to address the Palestinian question, wherever. But I think with Iran, whether the fact is, whatever he does, he knows that if he destroys Hamas, he destroys Hezbollah, as long as they haven't found a solution for the Iranian problem, and also a kind of any kind of peace or, I don't know, agreement with Iran, it will go on. So it's a very tricky question. Yeah. Indeed.
Very, very tricky question indeed. Wish we had more time. We do not, unfortunately. I want to thank you, Hamdan Mostafavi. I want to thank Itamar Rabinovich for being with us from Tel Aviv, Miriam Benrad in Nice, Hussein Ibish in Washington, Yerevan Gorgestani, your night's not over. We have more on our website, by the way, France24.com.